The topic, again, because we are looking at a situation which, to put it mildly, is moving and changing from day to day, so it was not easy to think of a simple question to ask. So the title is Crisis in Ukraine, Crisis in Russian-Western Relations, What Next? And I hope that's going to give our speakers, who have, are speaking from different viewpoints, an open programme upon which to speak. But I'm going to introduce them very briefly now, all in one go, and then I will ask them to speak in the same order. The first person I want to introduce, who is sitting on my left, is Oleksiy Salohubenko. He is the news and deployments editor at the BBC World Service. He's worked for the World Service since 1992. He was, from 2003 to 2008, covering BBC services for Russia, Ukraine, Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, and other countries. And from 1996 to 2003, he was head of the BBC Ukrainian service. So I think that there's a lot more I could say about him, but I hope that that will give you an indication of his expertise in this area. Second speaker on the far left, I don't think probably I need to introduce Andrew Wilson. He's spoken to us before. He presents Sky News daily since 2007, but also, as you will have noticed if you watch Sky, he occasionally isn't in the studio, but is on location in some of the hotter spots in the world. And he has recently been in Ukraine, and we thought it would be useful to get his perception from the viewpoint of a British journalist of what is happening on the ground. And the last speaker is Sir Andrew Wood, who's on my right. He was in the British diplomatic service from 1961 to 2000. He served in Moscow as ambassador from 1995 to 2000. He was twice in the embassy in Belgrade, the last time as ambassador, 1985 to 9, and twice in Washington. And since leaving the diplomatic service, he's returned regularly to Moscow on behalf of various UK-based interests. So we have a wide range of interest. If Chris Bryant turns up, then I will introduce him at that particular time. But I'm going to start by asking Oleksiy Salohubenko if he can talk to us.
I thought I would start from historical background of modern Ukraine, because it's very important to have a grasp of the country in order to understand what's going on now in Ukraine itself and relations with Russia. But then the dramatic developments over the past 2 days, I think, changed my plan. Nevertheless, I just want to mention as an introduction that in 21 years of Ukrainian independence, it had four presidents. One interim president, one president left. None of them were beheaded. They all had different agendas. They all had different views. They were not related to each other. They didn't have relatives in governments. Ukraine also had 12 prime ministers. One left, one is interim, none beheaded. Again, all had different interests. I think Ukraine also is a country of competitive parties, of competitive elections, of competitive media. And I think it is important to understand the nature of Ukrainian society by going back 20 years from now to the time when Leonid Kuchma, a very weak but very ambitious president, was elected. And one thing that he realized was that Ukraine obviously is divided, but he decided to put those divisions to use. Therefore, his approach to politics in Ukraine was divide and rule. He allowed clans, he allowed various oligarchs from different parts of the country to perform well in terms of business, to own media, to have competitive media, to fund competitive parties, to fund legally or semi-legally various MPs, various political groups. And I think that pluralism that perhaps by hook or by crook was established then, I think it still continues. As a result, Ukraine has quite a range of political groups and political parties from the far left to the far right, and obviously you've been hearing a lot about the far right, and if there's time later, I'm happy to go into the far right, and are they really far, are they really right, are they really as influential as described, the way they are portrayed very often. But this is all the background, I think, which is important for understanding what's going on. However, the events of the past 2 days, I think, need to be looked more closely. There was, after the annexation of Crimea, if you accept that, if you do not accept it, choose your own, but it looks like an annexation, feels like an annexation, and probably is an annexation. After those events, I think there was a certain lull in the protest movement in the Russian-speaking parts of Ukraine. There were some demonstrations in Luhansk, some demonstrations in Donetsk, some in Kharkiv, in Odessa, but there were counter-demonstrations as well. There were very big pro-Ukrainian groups in Odessa, for example, who came out, and we're talking about 10,000, 15,000, in Kherson, for example, or in Dnipropetrovsk. So all the eastern areas, if you imagine Ukraine sliced by the Dnieper River, so, and if you're looking down towards the Black Sea, all that left bank Ukraine was relatively peaceful, calm, and people were nominating candidates for the presidential elections. There was quite active sort of initial campaigning that started. The Party of the Regions of President Yanukovych lost quite a few members. Nevertheless, it nominated the former governor of Kharkiv region as its candidate for the presidential election. So there was a sense of normality that was being established. And I think central authorities got themselves into this feeling of lull and feeling of complacency. But what happened on Saturday and Sunday, I think, signifies quite a different turn of events. Relatively small demonstrations did take place in Donetsk, Luhansk, and Kharkiv, the three cities I'll talk about. Kharkiv is Ukraine's second largest city, and then Donetsk, the famous place, the center of the coal industry, founded by a Welsh engineer in the 19th century. The first name of Donetsk was Huzovka, in honor of John Hughes. And there's a monument in there, just as a sideline. I'll try. I thought my voice would go round the corner, but it obviously doesn't. I'll do my best.
Would you like to speak from there?
Will that be better?
Yeah.
I'll try from here. And then also the city of Luhansk, which is not the prettiest of places, but this is the place that is famous because it's the location of the only Ukrainian and the only Soviet locomotive factory. It still manufactures locomotives, only Russia buys them. But that's a big industrial place. So that industrial belt of the country all of a sudden saw demonstrations of around 1,500, 2,000 people, which went quite peacefully. And all of a sudden, in all three of those cities, small groups of about 100, 150 activists started to storm the buildings of SBU, which is the security service of Ukraine, and regional administration. They were very well coordinated, very well organized. Local police, either because of lack of loyalty to central authorities or because of, again, non-professionalism, it's very difficult to say now, did nothing to stop them. And as a result, in three cities, three government key government buildings were occupied. In Donetsk, I think, what happened there is very, very significant, because those people who were described by Russian media as activists, by Ukrainian media as separatists, they convened a session amongst themselves and all of a sudden declared the independent Donetsk Republic. And the first thing that they said they would do would be the referendum to join Russia. And the second thing that they did was to appeal to President Putin to send peacekeeping troops to protect the independent Donetsk Republic. A similar thing is going on, as far as I understand, judging from the latest updates, in Luhansk, in the building of the security service of Ukraine, which is also occupied. In Kharkiv, the situation is slightly calmer. Why those things are important? I mean, a lot of people are talking about the replay of the Crimean scenario when local MPs are under the guns of what was described by President Putin as self-defense. Everybody else was thinking there was Russian troops. Basically voted to declare Crimea an independent republic and then appeal to join Russia. And you know what followed through the referendum. That wasn't really a referendum, but nevertheless indicated that a lot of people in Crimea did want to join Russia. I think there are lots of parallels, and Ukrainian, certainly, authorities are very, very concerned that the same pattern may be repeated.
What's going on diplomatically is that there is an attempt to talk. Now I understand that Foreign Minister Lavrov and Andriy Deshchytsa, the Foreign Minister of Ukraine, have had a conversation. They disagreed again. I think there are new conditions. The Foreign Minister Lavrov is now saying that it will be important to have a multilateral discussion, the United States, European Union, Russia, and Ukraine, but Ukraine must be represented by the people from the east and south of the country, which is a new formula. This is moving ahead from the federalization that the Russian Federation was insisting on as a precondition to any kind of talks. Just one more diplomatic thing that I think is important. Viktor Ozerov, who is the chair of the Russian Parliamentary Committee on Security and Armed Forces and an advisor to President Putin, has been interviewed today, and he said two things, that Russia has the right to introduce peacekeeping troops into Ukraine, not just Crimea, but it's up to the president to define the numbers and the locations of peacekeeping troops if citizens are in danger. The previous line was if Russian speakers or Russians or compatriots are in danger. Now it's people, it's citizens. That's the first thing. The legality of this thing, he said that there are various shapes of how peacekeeping troops can be introduced. There could be the United Nations mandate, but there was a precedent of Georgia when President Shevardnadze, the legal president of Georgia, agreed within the framework of the CIS, the Confederation of Independent States, to send sending of Russian troops to Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Because in the Russian narrative, President Yanukovych is still the legal president of Ukraine, you may argue that the decisions of Ukraine to leave the CIS were illegal because they were not taken properly, and therefore there is a legal president, and he can invite the peacekeeping troops under the pretext of protecting the life of citizens as a humanitarian mission. I think, obviously, there are all sorts of caveats there, but caveats in terms of there isn't an intention, there isn't a plan, but the troops are there. There hasn't been any massive withdrawal. I think Jane Defense Weekly published interesting photographs yesterday of deployments. So I think this is something, this is the texture of what's going on there. But I think one other thing that I wanted to mention before I close. There was a very, very interesting survey done actually in March, between 16th and 24th of March. It's a survey by the International Republican Institute. It's quite representative. They've been doing it for many, many years. And there's a very interesting result here. The question is, do you support the decision of the Russian Federation to send its army to protect Russian-speaking citizens of Ukraine? In the west of the country, definitely no, 93%. In the south of the country, definitely no, 51%. However, in the east of the country, only 49% said that they don't want to do it. And the picture is very, very different if you look at the same question by ethnicity. Do you support the decision of the Russian Federation to send its army to protect Russian-speaking citizens in Ukraine? Ethnic Ukrainians, 80%, say definitely no. Ethnic Russians, only 32% say definitely no. So whatever the political repercussions, whatever the dialogue, whatever the narratives of different countries, whatever the facts on the ground, I think we can talk about divisions in Ukraine. I mentioned at the beginning of my presentation the positive sides of it, that the way this division shaped Ukrainian society. However, that same division creates a very, very volatile mixture, which those who want to make Ukraine weaker, to have it under control, can certainly use under the circumstances that appeared over the past 2 days.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask Andrew Wilson.
Michael, thanks very much indeed for inviting me. This is the best spot, given the circumstances. Now, there's all sorts of things, even in the short time that we had over lunch, talking to people, there's all sorts of issues which people are concentrating on or thinking about going forwards. People were talking to me about Belarus, of course, the concern about what's been happening in the east of Ukraine in the last couple of days. A sort of certainty in the room about the trickery of what's going on in the Kremlin, the double speak, the double standards, all that's almost a matter of record now. And I think perhaps during the whole hour we can consider the overriding question, which is whether or not this is another sign of Russia deciding to expand, or whether it's another gasp in the gradual decline of the Russian Federation. That's not for me to talk about right now, but it may come up, and it's certainly something that sort of overshadows the points I'd like to make. I was in Crimea recently for about 2 or 3 weeks, if you include my trip to Kiev as well, to Maidan Square. Mostly I lived off Salanka soup. I don't know if you know what Salanka soup is, but it's basically, they call it the kitchen soup. It's basically whatever is left in the fridge goes into this soup. And I think what I'm going to give you now is everything I got in the fridge while I was out there for the last 3 weeks, and as a kind of a recipe, but not necessarily the finished dish, but just things for you to think about. It was clear the moment we arrived in Simferopol that this annexation of Crimea was going to be very slick indeed. It really seemed that by the time the West had figured out what was going on, it had already happened. Sergei Aksionov, this man fresh to politics, but also a recent student I learned of referendums, he sat on plenty of parliamentary committees looking at ethnic, social implications of independence in Transnistria, for example, even further afield in Quebec, Catalonia. And all that remained was for him to become prime minister. And when the guns and balaclavas appeared, he mysteriously marched unimpeded into office. So on the ground then, take the example of, say, a young businessman in Crimea. Say, selling a part of a franchise, selling Volkswagen cars in Simferopol. Let's call him Vadim. He looks at Russia, wealthy, a historic neighbour, sharing a common language with a growing middle class of potential customers, showing some real determination. And then he looks at Europe. Austerity, thousands of Poles and Romanians welcomed as cheap labour and then condemned for taking jobs in welfare. He looks at the promise to protect the sovereignty of Ukraine in return for ditching nuclear weapons and how that seemed to dissolve. He sees the growing number of wealthy oligarchs spending their gains not in Moscow and Kiev, but in London and Nice and Paris. And if he looks closely enough, he might even make out some stories of politicians censured over their expenses and white elephant infrastructure projects built on euro loans. And suddenly Vadim's invited to take part in a referendum. He makes his choices, but what's that got to do with us? International law has been violated, but actually, Vadim probably doesn't care, precisely because of the Soviet legacy, the talk of Nazis and anti-Semites, the less than impressive display of leadership by the White House. As far as Vadim's concerned, it's still the same as it ever was. Survive within the reality. I think for now, therefore, and the foreseeable future, Crimea is lost to Ukraine. What happens next? Well, Vladimir Putin's gone on television to call this a victory, a historic wrong that has finally been put right. Mikhail Gorbachev has said that he agrees. And the Moscow media have collectively penned column after column talking about the disgrace of perestroika, how Russia has achieved finally the kind of greatness that it last enjoyed in Soviet times. Hard for the Kremlin to even remotely reconsider its actions as hasty. The West, meanwhile, appears unsure both of what to do and indeed what it wants to see happen. The breaking of international law is matched by the twisting of Russian law regarding annexation, neighbours, and the requirements for consultation. The sanctions will bite a bit, but not much. And the lines for escalation on both sides are vague. And I say that even with what's been happening in the last couple of days in the East. But the East, of course, is an area of concern. It is one of those lines that perhaps we're most focused on. The Russians say, of course, they'll negotiate with Kiev about the country's future, but already with the conditions laid out, Russian as a second language, military neutrality, and most awkward of all, of course, is this decentralization of power to Russian-speaking regions, a federal Ukraine. If not, well, military exercises continue on the border, and Russian so-called tourists remain in and around Kharkov and Donetsk, and ominously there appears to be plenty of energy still for disruption there, although Putin has declared the principle of taking Crimea is based on the precedent of Kosovo. And if he sticks with that, then he has no real entitlement in his own words to go into eastern Ukraine. Nevertheless, of course, people are nervous. It's also vague because Ukraine isn't NATO. That's a red line even the White House wouldn't fumble. But this is a country sitting between two huge powers, as Alexei has been telling us, trying to manage its own business, which in 21st century Europe, along with a couple of others, makes it almost unique. Also, what I picked up on the ground was the suspicions of an older generation that still remembers the real horrors of the Second World War. There's still a belief passed on from grandparent to grandchild that the unthinkable can always happen. We learned a bit about rampant corruption that's left Ukraine with some of the shoddiest infrastructure in Europe. Outrageously wealthy oligarchs, the long arm of Moscow and Gazprom, and almost zero investment in its own natural resources. Reform on Western lines starts to appear like a big ask. The IMF can and might negotiate the beginnings of a bailout, but the conditions may appear to Kiev as draconian as the Russian terms. They'll focus on rule of law, an overhaul of the judiciary, indeed even the makeup of the Rada itself, perhaps. And anyway, ahead of elections, it's not clear still who actually holds the momentum in Kiev. We were introduced to these right-wingers. At first, guys in balaclavas marching up and down Independence Square, getting back into their lorries and going away. But gradually it became clear that they were representatives of a kind of political movement. Svoboda has always been in a minority in the Rada, but it still has representation now. And it was their activists, bussed in from Western Ukraine, who charged the Berkut snipers, not the liberal middle classes. So they have cast themselves as the rightful guardians of Maidan. Heavy-handed, bullish, sometimes violent in the face of criticism, but they're feeding fears of Russian invasion, they're feeding fears of tanks in Donetsk, because it suits them. And they're the ones that, if it comes to confrontation with Russia, will try to lead the political charge. They're not the same people who want to take the Russians to court over gas prices while wooing the IMF for support, but they're vying for the same influence at home. And also, I also spent some time based in Moscow, and I recognise that there's still plenty of the old Russian soul knocking around in Ukraine, particularly, of course, in Crimea, what they used to call Sovietsky Narod. The deep emotional ties cemented by history, blood, nostalgia for communism, and a nostalgia for a shared enterprise. And our mistake, I think, is to think that once the younger generation grows out of that, they'll naturally turn to the West. That suddenly the individual will seize the initiative and shape a new future. True, I spoke to plenty of university students who were horrified at the prospect of their European future being snatched away by this referendum, but I'll tell you, young Vadim, the car salesman, didn't feel like that at all. There's a message still knocking about in Brussels and Washington, as far as people there are concerned, that our way is the only way. And that keeps us from being as helpful internationally as we might. If Ukraine wants to go it alone, which in many ways it already is, then the hands-on, hands-off has to be delicate and it has to be clever. It's much better that the nationalists and the modernizers in Kiev find common cause and then become forced under the international spotlight to choose between two opposing roads. So regarding Russian ambitions, well, let's accept that even this latest boost to national pride, this stretches at worst to eastern Ukraine. Maybe Belarus, and I know already that people in Belarus are nervous too, but it doesn't stretch to NATO countries. And anyway, this isn't Poland or Romania or even the Baltic states. These are the real gates to the east, and culturally, therefore, a much more complicated proposition. Russia does have the advantage. An academic in Simferopol tried his hardest to clarify to me the relationship between Russia and Ukraine. And in the end, he lumped for England and Wales. The butt of jokes, a sense of not being taken seriously, a consistent and powerful expression of independence, but in a standoff against Westminster, not a chance. Well, his analysis, not mine, but it helped to get how they tried to explain the situation that they were in. I think Crimea is a step too far for Brussels, not important enough for Washington. If it goes no further, Putin gets a pass. If there's conflict in the East, then Europe will apply a further mix of non-commitment and selective punishment. So the progression has to be diplomatic. Sergei Lavrov, as we read in The Guardian on Monday, he's ready to talk, but his speech is already written. And it's going to be hard to draw further engagement from the Kremlin. You know, after all the slights that Putin felt about Iraq and Syria and all the rest of it, the chemical weapons win last year means that he can coast a little further on this one. It's also interesting that neither Lavrov nor even Sergei Shoigu in Defence Ministry appear to have been much involved with the original deployments in Crimea. They can genuinely shrug and roll their eyes and sort of mean it. Probably Crimea was the win to reinstall some of the pride that Russia lost during even the chaotic Yeltsin years. Ukraine might be the spoiler to test things a little further. Trade talks will get tougher for a bit, but we hope that Putin won't actually turn off the gas. And diplomacy will probably adjust to a new status quo. Still, from time to time, people do jokingly refer to Archduke Ferdinand. And they laugh, but they also shiver just a little at the same time. Thank you.
I'm now going to call on Sir Andrew Wood to talk to us. Chris Brad, our fourth speaker, has arrived. I've asked him if he would say a few words at the end, in a sense, perhaps summarising what he's heard since he got here.
Or disagreeing with it.
Sorry?
Or disagreeing with it.
Or disagreeing with it, yes, but it'll give you a chance. I want to get this out to the floor and see as soon as I can. Andrew.
I will be very brief for the admirable reason that I know what I think, but I'd like to hear the questions. What I will try and do is answer the question that Andrew Wilson put as to the fate of Russia and how durable its position can be in relation to Ukraine and the rest of the world. I think it is actually a lot weaker than it seems, although I accept what Andrew said about the immediate situation. I think I would like to return, first of all, to the question that started all this off. And this was not a question of whether the East, or this wasn't for us a question, of whether the East or the West should have Ukraine. It was a straight question of whether corrupt, incompetent, and thieving misgovernment would win in Ukraine. That's what started it. And the offer of EU association seemed to many young people in the East as well in the West as the way to escape this dilemma. It got out of hand because of the attempts that were made to suppress the Maidan by force, which ended up with some shooting, as we all know. And it ended up like that in part because Russia supported, encouraged, and endorsed those efforts. The reason that Russia ultimately was on that side of the fence and not on the side of reform and a better government, rule of law, and so on and so forth, is because Russia shares too many parallels to be comfortable with the Yanukovych regime. We will hear and have heard before about the need to keep Ukraine out of NATO, about the Western interference in Ukraine, but that is essentially either untrue or beside the point. I think it is a straight question of the nature of the regime in Ukraine, which was objectionable to Russia. If you look at Russia after the return of Putin to the Kremlin in May 2012, you will see three main things. First of all, there's been no economic reform. There has been no economic reform because of the second thing. That is that political reform is too dangerous to the regime. What there has been instead is the third thing, suppression. We have a very strong suppression of free comment, free political association, and therefore, ultimately, we have the undermining of the possibility of Russia beginning to change itself. So the effort to preserve a fading but still very powerful regime in Russia tied in with the necessary, perhaps, propaganda for those purposes of anti-Westernism, of everything is the fault of the United States in particular, or more advantageously now, you can say the EU as well. It's presenting the EU as though it's a force for coordinated action, and if there's anyone in the room that believes that, then I'd be amazed. Now we have to look at the question of what are the extent of Russian ambitions. At the least, they will want to destabilize Ukraine so that it can no longer be the sort of challenge that it potentially was. And you can actually see the people trying in Maidan, at first peacefully, but then under pressure, in some cases using force. What they were trying to do was the same sort of thing as many people who supported, for example, the 2011-12 protests in Moscow would like to do for Russia. That is to produce a government which is answerable to the people and able to change. Russia is now unable to change and frozen. I must just get it out for myself, I can never quite remember, but it's Edmund Burke rightly said, a state without the means of some change is without the means of its conservation. That is not far off a summary of where Russia finds itself today. So lastly, what are the Western interests in this? The Western interest is not, has not been and should not be to try to take over Ukraine as some sort of geopolitical gesture. We can't afford it. It wouldn't work. But it is a very convenient thing for Russian propaganda to pretend. And Russian propaganda has been extraordinarily effective, extraordinarily mendacious, and extraordinarily persistent. Secondly, what we should be doing is therefore doing our best to support those who advocate change in the direction of responsible government in Kiev. We will, in our own interests, have to look to our own defences, and I think those that have called attention to the need for NATO to be restored more closely to the centre of our imagination are absolutely correct. Not because NATO is a force which is inimical to Russia, but because we have every interest in sticking together as effectively as we can to defend our interests. I agree with Andrew Wilson that it's not for us, therefore, to try to force a choice on Ukraine. I think that we should, however, bear firmly in mind the fact that Russia, too, will eventually need our friendly cooperation in the changes which one day will come. I find them a bit difficult to see how they're going to come under the present regime. And a potential corollary of that is, in the eyes of many Russians, that the present regime will collapse in a very distressing way. I was ambassador in Yugoslavia when Milosevic was beginning his rise, and I knew him very well. The last thing I said to him when I took my leave of Serbia was that he should remember that those who live by the sword also die by the sword. He said, "You've not understood. People are grateful to me for restoring order." That is the sort of consolation, I think, which appears to the Kremlin today. There is an association for Russian minds between keeping order and the anarchy which follows unstructured change. We can have every sympathy with that, as we can have every sympathy with those in Ukraine who fear what's happened in their country as being unreconstructed change. But I do not believe, either in Russia or in Ukraine, is a frozen status quo possible. So in the end, I look forward with some hope to what may come out of Ukraine. I look forward to the present in Russia with considerable grief, but in the end, one must have hope too. So thank you very much.
I'm now going to take 15 minutes of questions or comments, because I think quite a lot of you will want to take part. Can you please keep your comments or questions as short as possible? And as I say, if you would introduce yourself at the beginning. Yes.
I noticed that all three speakers never mentioned religion. And religion is always an important thing in foreign policy. Obviously, coming from Northern Ireland, I recognize the importance of religion. But in British diplomatic service, we fail to recognize the importance of religion in Afghanistan, in the Middle East, Pakistan, countries like that. As one watched the revolution in Kiev, one saw clerics very actively involved in the demonstrations. What is the role of religion in Ukraine, and why do British politicians ignore it?
I'm going to take groups of three, because I think we'll get through more that way. Gentleman around the corner.
Charles Grant from the Centre for European Reform. Andrew mentioned Belarus, and since I was there the week before last, I might have to pass on a couple of thoughts about what's happening there. People in Belarus are very nervous about what's happening in Ukraine. One thing that opposition leaders and President Lukashenko agree on is that they would like to maintain the independence of their country from Russia, and it has remained independent, but that independence may be disappearing because of the very dire state of the Belarusian economy. It's last year had a current account deficit of 10% of GDP, that's $7 billion. This year it'll be worse. They cannot possibly plug that deficit except through loans. Who's going to give them the money? Probably only Russia. In return for conditions, such as support on Ukraine, which they're getting now, such as privatisation, which would allow Russian oligarchs to buy up the country, and so on. So there is a real worry about losing independence. So I just finished with one point about the EU. The Belarusians are now resuming their on-off flirtation with the EU, as is that the EU is responding. Last time this happened in 2009, it did lead to the release of political prisoners in Belarus. The EU got some money for Belarus in return, and it all went wrong when Lukashenko arrested the opposition leaders. But the EU now has to decide, is it prepared to engage Belarus in the hope of preserving its independence, despite the fact that the regime is going to remain a dictatorship?
There was a gentleman from the Russian embassy who asked earlier. Yes. We'll keep it brief if we could.
Yes, we know you are.
Naturally, the focus of the debate now is on the recent events. But I have noticed, just following it very thoroughly, that it never came up what started the entire exercise. And it was the EU exercise in trying to unilaterally bring Ukraine to some new state of mind, let's say, to some new station and state. And also, I heard it from Sergei Lavrov, he said that he always inquired with his EU colleagues what was cooking when the association agreement was drafted. And he was told it was none of your business, you'll see when it's an issue. Of course, this is fascinating that the EU believed so much in signatures under the document that they waited for the document to be issued. But anyway, we always expressed our willingness to manage the Ukraine together, trilateral. Why that was not done? We have never been explained how the issue was debated in the EU in the first place. That's my issue to question to whoever may answer it.
Thank you very much. I'm now going to take responses from our panel. Who'd like to go first?
I can do the religion.
Okay, we'd like to do the religion.
In terms of religion, I think religious issue in Ukraine is very complicated, but not too complicated, as is often presented. The bulk of the country is Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox religion. However, about 10% is Union Church, which is the basically Orthodox Church, which recognizes the authority of the Pope. And that was because of the divisions in Ukraine, because part of Ukraine became part of Rzeczpospolita, the Polish dukedom in the past, and therefore part of the clergy and part of the aristocracy there, part of the nobility, decided that in order to preserve their privileges under Polish Catholic rule, it would be expedient for them to take part, you know, to recognize the authority of the Pope. There is a very small Roman Catholic population, and there's a rising evangelical population of Baptists. The interim president of Ukraine, Alexander Turchynov, is actually an evangelical Baptist and a novel writer. However, the presence of priests in Ukraine during the protests was extremely important because they were representing different communities. And one other thing that is important, that Ukrainian church is split in its allegiance. Part of the church recognizes the authority of Patriarch of Moscow, and part of the parishioners recognize the authority of the Patriarch of Kiev, Filaret. So there are splits even there. But talking of religion, one important thing that was absent in Moscow during the President Putin acceptance speech, the Crimea acceptance speech, was Patriarch Kirill of all Russia. Because none of the religious leaders, either in Russia or in Ukraine, supported the annexation of Crimea. And that is, I think, a very, very important position of the church, either in Russia or in Ukraine.
Thank you. Andrew?
Just a comment about the question relating to EU Ukrainian negotiations. That is to make appear sinister what is perfectly obvious. We do not regard Ukraine or Russia or Latvia or Kyrgyzstan or something as something to be managed by two outside powers. Ukraine wished to negotiate an association agreement with EU, and that was negotiated. May have been a good idea, may have been a bad idea, but it was nothing to do with Russia anyway, and nothing actually within the competence of a single country of the EU either.
Thank you very much. I'm going to carry on another three questions. The gentleman against the wall.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm Deputy Ambassador of Ukraine, and I would like a bit echo the question or replica of my former Russian friends, Mr. Well, it was not the EU who sent the people to the Kiev street to be killed by the governmental arms. It was not the EU actually who started shooting. It was the people of Ukraine who decided to join the European family. And it was the attempts of one big former friendly nation to prevent this desire by any means. And another evidence of that, just the political shelter of the military crime, Mr. Yanukovych, on the territory of Russia. But this is besides. I would like just to echo the statement of Mr. Sologubenko. He told that the situation in west-eastern Ukraine a bit changed these days, but he didn't mention why. Yes, from the more or less peaceful protests, we are witnessing the aggressive actions of small troops, which are equipped and paid by the Russian money. For that reason, we are thinking about the next possible means to halt that aggression. It was told by the EU, it was told by the British government that the next, the third stage of the sanctions against the Russian will be the further aggravation of the situation. Now we have the Russian special forces on our territory. We have evidence. Please, do you think that the third stage of the sanctions already is the timely response? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin Butler. Could you stand up?
I beg your pardon, yeah. Just wanted to ask about the economic consequences of the situation in Ukraine for the West. What does the panel think will be the effect on oil and gas prices, not in Ukraine, but for the West, and also on the wheat harvest?
Chairman, could the speakers also please be asked to stand, because they really are almost invisible.
Yes. When answering, if you could stand up. Gentleman at the front.
Christopher Samuel, should Finland, who are not in NATO but in the EU and are adjacent to Russia and have historical links, be worried?
Who'd like to take that last point first? Interesting.
I think Finland is worried, and ideas have been toyed with, at least in both Sweden and Finland, of the possible advantages of coming closer to NATO. Should Finland be worried in the sense that it has a large Russian minority waiting to wave flags and storm buildings? Well, no. But the consequences for Finland, for the Baltic states, and for former Soviet territories as a whole is obviously troubling. And it's one of the big mistakes the Russian government has made. It's shown its signature is worth nothing. It's declared its intention to protect the interests, as it cares to establish them at the time, of Russian speakers in every territory. About 25% of the population of Kazakhstan is Russian speaking. I'm not saying that means the Russians are instantly going to take action in Kazakhstan, but it does mean if you're President Nazarbayev, you're going to think about it.
In terms of gas prices, economy, and wheat harvest, there is some serious crisis, I think, brewing in terms of gas and deliveries in Ukraine. The latest, Mr. Medvedev met with Mr. Miller the other day, the chairman of Gazprom, and insisted on raising price yet again. There were two price hikes from 286 to 385, and now it's $485 per 100 cubic meters of gas, which is quite an increase. In addition to that, Russia says that there's a debt, but there's also lost profit. The way it is calculated is quite interesting. The Russian government argues that the previous deal was under the lease of Sevastopol naval base until 2017. Since now Sevastopol conveniently is part of the Russian Federation, there's no need of having any lease. And therefore all future discounts are counted as lost profit, which is where, I know it's a bit complicated perhaps, but this is where the figure of 11 billion additional debt comes from. So the total debt, according to the Kremlin calculation now, is $16 billion. The threat of switch-off continues, and there are also rather menacing signals about Ukraine trying to diversify supplies of gas, particularly getting gas from Germany, from Slovakia, from Hungary and other countries in a reverse flow. I think there was a statement from Mr. Kuprianov, a spokesman from Gazprom, who was saying that the legality of those deals is very, very questionable, and certainly there's a lot of pressure on Slovakia, as far as I understand, of not doing it. So the situation with gas is very, very precarious. The reserves now in Ukrainian reserve facilities are rather small. Usually they're on the level of 21, 23 billion cubic meters. Now they're on the level of 7, I think, and falling. So Ukraine, without any additional help, cannot pay that price. And it will go to arbitration. How successful and how quick that will be is not clear. In terms of wheat harvest, luckily, the wheat belt of Ukraine is not in the areas of current turmoil. It's more to central Ukraine, Poltava, and all the way to the west. So there's nothing to indicate that there is a problem there. But the price of petrol, the price of fuel, the price of chemicals, all will go up. So I think the cost of Ukrainian wheat will probably go up as well.
Andrew, would you like to respond to the Ukraine?
You know, there's no doubt that the east of the country is the biggest guessing game we've got at the moment. And also the question about Finland as well. You know, the first military exercises after the crisis started in earnest were the ones held on the Finnish border, just to remind anyone in the north of to the northern part of the Russian border where they might stand as well. So there's a lot of saber-rattling going on, a lot of intimidation going on. Looking at what happened in Crimea, there was no doubt that the Cossacks that you saw lined up arm in arm, disciplined and quiet, around the parliament and around some of the military bases, almost all of them, or the ones we managed to speak to and could kind of work out who was friends with who, came from Russia. They hadn't come from, they weren't local Crimeans, they weren't local Ukrainians. The militia that were co-opted into that, the kind of guys that stood around braziers and drank vodka all night and took all the blows so that the Cossacks could remain unaccountable, they were locals. And there's plenty of those locals knocking around in the east should they need to organise those. I think the one encouraging thing that the Kiev can take on board about the situation in Donetsk and Kharkiv, and this is, I didn't go there myself, but from the colleagues of mine who are working there, is that what we saw in Crimea was the Russian movement was so surreptitious, was so discreet. Clearly they were mindful of the fact that to turn up like ghosts, the actual soldiers, was a very important part of the annexation. They didn't cross any borders. I would say almost all the soldiers we saw came from the bases in and around Sevastopol. There was no obvious movement across the border. I can see you shaking your head. However, rest assured now...
And officially detected by the Ukrainian reconnaissance.
And it's also a matter of record, the Ukrainian Defense Ministry said there were 30,000 Russian troops on the ground, and it was difficult to count them, obviously. But to see them coming across the border in the east would be a much more overt act. There are already OSCE deployment in the region with the blessing of both sides of this argument, in other words, with the blessing of Brussels and with the blessing of Moscow. So this idea that Lavrov has raised of Russian peacekeeping troops is probably the most worrying development of all, that they now feel that they have a right to have a presence there if citizens feel threatened, which we're already experienced in the understanding that Russians are quite clear at saying people are feeling threatened, whether they are or they aren't. So it remains tentative, but I think it would be a mistake right now for Kiev to start deploying troops in any numbers or armour in the area, because that would certainly do its part to raise the stakes. But one can understand that those cities, there's an awful lot of turbulence going on because it's not clear. But that border is far more naked and able to be inspected than the slim one over the water there between Crimea and Russia.
I'm afraid the clock is catching up with us.
The question of sanctions, he did not respond.
I might ask Chris if he could respond to that when he comes to respond. I can take one more. I'm sorry, others have asked to come in, but I only have time for one, Patricia.
Really, very quick. Addressed to Sir Andrew, and others of the speakers have all mentioned Finland, Belarus, parts of Ukraine, Moldova, etc. All fear Putin and the Russians. But at the same time, you said that Putin and Russia are both weak. I don't quite understand why they can all be fearful and yet Russia be called weak.
Very brief. It's a question of timescale. At present, Russia is running out of money, and it's also a question of the degree of political fragility there is within Russia. The people are on a bit of a high at present, partly out of relief because here's at last something we seem to have done right. But that is a feeling which will go, and there will be a problem of accountability in the longer run, as well as weakness of the political system.
I apologise to those I haven't called, but I now get to ask our fourth speaker, Chris Bryant, MP for the Rhondda, who was the Minister for Europe at the end of the last Labour government. I know has strong views on this, but you could just say a few words to us, take us up to 2 o'clock.
I think I've probably got strong views on nearly everything, but anyway. I just want to start because the first meeting I had as Europe Minister was with a Russian minister. He came in within about 3 days of my being appointed as Europe Minister, Mr. Karasin. And we were talking about Georgia, and he said, well, when that Georgian soldier started shooting, which was the pretext for us going to war, and I said, I presume you don't mean pretext, do you? You mean reason, and because he speaks perfect English. And he said, he just smiled. What I really want to ask is, what more do we need to know about President Putin's views on how Russia should conduct itself in the international community than that single sentence, really, which is that where there is a pretext, they will use it and exploit it to its maximum effect. I just look at the Budapest Memorandum, and our colleague from the Russian embassy said earlier that they respect signatures. Well, there were four signatures on there, the United States of America, France, the UK and Russia, all saying that they guaranteed the territorial integrity of Ukraine in exchange, effectively, for Ukraine surrendering nuclear weapons. None of this would have been possible if the Budapest Memorandum had not been signed and if Ukraine hadn't taken that action in the 1990s. And so I think that there is a fundamental failure of honesty by the Russian state, and I think that they've used these moments as a pretext. I give you one thing to President Putin. He is very good at seizing the initiative when the initiative is there to be seized. But I think his long-term strategy is absolutely clear. Whether it's internally, and you can, you know, there's so many names that you just have to throw into the equation to remind people of the kleptocratic nature and the dictatorial nature of the Russian regime, Litvinenko, Magnitsky, Anna Politkovskaya, and so on. But for me, the most worrying factor for all of us in countries under the NATO umbrella is that the first sentence of the present, recently, well, reformed 3 years ago, Russian statement of military doctrine is the first sentence is the biggest threat to Russia's security is NATO. Now, if that's what your starting point, then it seems to me it's fairly obvious where you're going to go in the long term. And the truth is that Russia is now a national security state. It uses all the apparatus, including religion, incidentally, apart from, as has been pointed out in this one key moment at the moment, which may prove to be quite an interesting fracture within the system. It uses all the organs of the state to enforce a very difficult, problematic situation, which is that the personal enrichment of Putin is way beyond the dreams of Imelda Marcos, Gaddafi and Yanukovych all put together. There is no means of Putin leaving power. And that is a very dangerous position. It's a weakness for him, to answer the lady who asked the question there. It's a personal weakness for him, but it's also a very dangerous position for us. I spoke to a Russian embassy official, not in the UK, 10 days ago, and said, you know, how worried should we be about the situation? And he said, no, it's fine, because Putin is not yet mad. Well, that didn't really reassure me. It was the not yet bit that... So even a Russian embassy official thought that there was a real danger of Putin's madness. And there is another weakness in the Russian system, which is the fundamental economic weakness, which is that, to all intents and purposes, Russia is a monogorod. It is an economy that is based on petrocarbons and nothing else. And in the long term, that is completely unsustainable. And all the economic reforms that there should have been, all the political reforms that need to accompany economic reform, all the carving out of, taking out of the corruption so that international business can do business properly in Russia, all of those things have failed to transpire over the last 15 years, and that's the long-term problem. Some people were rude about the EU. I actually thought it would be worse. I thought the EU would be less united than it has been. I think they've made one fundamental error, and I think Cameron's made this error as well. I don't think personally targeted sanctions against members of the top table actually are very effective, because all it does is it makes the people at the top table say, right, we're staying at the top table and none of us is leaving, because we're all in this together. I would much prefer to see the kind of sanctions that have a wider effect, would cost us in the West, might cost people in Germany and France and Italy and elsewhere. But I do have some hopes. Berlusconi is not there to go to bunga bunga parties in Russia and listen to ABBA tribute bands with President Putin. There are, I think Cyprus is beginning to understand that it cannot be a harbour for dodgy Russian money. Though, incidentally, I think that British authorities should have done far more over the last 20 years to be able to tackle that issue. And I also think that the whole of the EU now is beginning to wake up to the fact that the Balkans is not necessarily as quiet as it might be for the future. And the visit of Dodik to Russia, I'm going to finish now, Michael, but the visit of Dodik to Russia, I think, was rather worrying. Because I think Cathy Ashton, many people had many criticisms of Cathy when she arrived in post. I think she's actually done a rather brilliant job. She's not tried to bring peace to the Middle East and do things that would be impossible in that post. She's selected specific things where she can make a difference, as on Croatia, Serbia, my anxiety is that Serbia is now going to go in precisely the wrong direction because of what's happened in Crimea. So I don't know whether anybody asked the question of how worried should we be. But I personally live in a state of permanent worry. Yes, and I'm